The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2014 Annual Conference, copyright 2014. If you have purchased this recording, you are free to make multiple copies for your school's use. You may not sell copies of the audio or post copies on the internet. Order additional conference recordings from this year's conference or previous conferences at store.accsedu.org. Find out more about the Association of Classical and Christian Schools at www.accsedu.org. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Bradley Finkbeiner. I'll be teaching you about the nature of proof today. And if you would turn with me in your outline there on page 50, I wanted to make a brief comment about that outline. I'm going to do my level best to follow it, but in the process of working through the material, it dawned on me that maybe order of exposition needs to be altered a little bit. So what I'm going to do is give you some signposts along the way, and we're going to jump a few times in the outline. So nothing really new here. Everything in the outline will be dealt with, but in a somewhat different order. But I'll tip you off to when we are bouncing around in that outline. Okay, the title of this talk, The Nature of Proof, came out of my personal frustrations as a teacher and as a student of the theory of knowledge, philosophy, logic, debate. Obviously, the nature of proof is something that would be of interest to me. But in the classroom, I found oftentimes that students use the word proof in different ways, and so did their teachers. Imagine if you're a student at a classical school and you go into the science class first period, and the teacher says, "Science cannot really prove anything." And then he or she explains why. And then that same student goes to their second period Bible class, and their teacher says, "Theology is not like science. For if faith could be proved, it would no longer be faith." Then the student goes off to the third period apologetics class, where the teacher says, "There are many compelling proofs for the resurrection." Now, if we're teaching our students to think consistently and to integrate across classes, the sharper students are going to recognize by the time they get to third period that their teachers aren't speaking the same language, they're not on the same page, and apparently contradicting each other, right? How many of you teach a rhetoric class, as in rhetoric proper, not rhetoric level, but, okay, one or two? You know that the whole point, or I shouldn't say the whole point, but much of the purpose of the paper is to prove a thesis statement. And then much of the grade will be based on whether or not they've succeeded. Well, if we don't have a common vocabulary of what it means to prove, of what it looks like, how do you know you proved it when you have done it? How is that teacher going to give a consistent grade from paper to paper? How is the student going to know what the teacher is even expecting of them? There needs to be more of a common language, not just between teacher and student, but between teachers. What should we mean by proof? I'm going to start off by giving you my answer up front, just directly, and then we'll dive into it as the session goes on. In the strict sense, proof means a sound argument with verified premises. In a loose sense, it's a strong argument whose premises have been verified or justified. Give you a second to write that down. I'm not defining those terms at present. We'll do that later. But I would recommend that you come up with a language like this that you could hold your students accountable for, obviously in the logic class, but on through the poetic stage. All right, well, let me move on here. And building up to those definitions of proof that I just gave you, students should learn to distinguish a number of the elements that go into it. The first element that goes into the nature of proof is proposition, or propositions. Proofs are always directed to propositions. If someone says, can you prove that? What's the that referring to? It's referring to a proposition. Can you prove that Jesus rose from the dead? Can you prove that Christians have a moral duty to vote? Can you prove that men evolved from primates, right? There's always a that clause. There's always a proposition that's being asked about or wondered about when someone asks you if you can prove something. And what is a proposition? Well, it's not that hard to understand. It's an indicative sentence. Earth is spherical. It's a pretty good example of that. We need to be careful here, though, when we're describing what a proposition is. It's a little bit misleading to say a proposition is a statement of fact, assertion of fact. Oftentimes they're defined that way. The problem with that definition is, if you look at those two examples, earth is spherical, earth is flat, if you define a proposition as an assertion of fact, the sharper kids are going to say, well, wait a second, earth is not flat, it's spherical, so how can that be a statement of fact? That's a good question. What we need to do is say a proposition is a sentence, a tool we use to communicate what we believe are facts. So we all in this room hopefully would use that first proposition and not the second one. Although you might have someone who argues that the earth is flat and they're using that proposition to assert what they think is in fact real, true. The significance of this point will come up momentarily. All right, facts. How's this for a bad definition? That which exists or has existed, whether an object, person, event, action, nature, property, relation, or state of affairs. The reason why that's so convoluted is because there's no agreement on what a fact even is. If you look up definitions of fact, they're all over the map. And I think that's significant because people say, I just believe in facts. Have very often no idea what they mean by that statement. And all you have to do is ask them, what's a fact? What do you mean by that? And within seconds, they realize they don't know what they just said. They don't understand the assertion they just made. And we've got to bias our students to think very, very carefully and philosophically about the nature of facts from a Christian worldview. And I'll do that today. I'll help you guys think that one through. All right. How do these relate? We use propositions with the intention of pointing out facts, but we do not always succeed. Right? The first proposition here is successful. The second is a failure. Success and failure here are measured by correspondence. The success or failure of your use of a proposition is measured by its correspondence to the facts. Are things as the proposition purports them to be. And this, of course, leads to the definition of truth, with which many of you are, I'm sure, familiar. All meaningful propositions will have truth value, which is the property of being either true or false. A proposition's truth value is determined by whether the facts are as the proposition purports them to be. The proposition is true if the facts correspond, otherwise it's false. And we need to get clear here that truth value is a property of a proposition, meaning that propositions have this quality. When we talk about truth, we're talking about propositions. Is a proposition true or false? We're not saying that all propositions are true or that all propositions are false. We're saying that of any given proposition, it's either true or false, right? On, off, black, white. And the truth of that, the truth value, is what we call objective. Right now, I could put up on the board, say, a proposition that there is an even number of people in this room. That has truth value I don't even know what the truth value is, though, right? If there's an even number of people, then the truth value of that proposition is true. If not, then the truth value of that proposition is false. But the truth value is something the proposition has regardless of what we believe about it. It's objective. It's not subjective. Whether you believe it's true doesn't affect its truth value. And this is something that we've got to hammer into our students' minds. The truth value of a claim is independent of our belief or disbelief in that claim. What makes a claim true or false is reality, not us. We're trying to figure out whether claims are true or false by going to reality, by going to the facts, and looking for correspondence. Little minor note here, but sometimes fact and truth are used interchangeably, and strictly they're different. The Earth being the third planet from the sun is a fact, but the proposition asserting this fact is true. Again, facts are what make propositions true. All right. Have any of you seen this movie? The Gods Must Be Crazy? It starts off with these, I don't know, Australians, Americans flying over the Kalahari Desert, and they chuck out a Coke bottle. And I believe, I haven't seen it forever, I think it hits the guy in the head. But in any case, the guy holding the bottle finds this, and he's perplexed. He has no idea what this thing is, right? We know it's an empty glass Coke bottle, right? In our culture, it's obviously an empty glass Coke bottle. He has no clue, though, what this thing is. And he takes it back to the tribe, and they're all perplexed, and they're using it for different purposes. Some are using it to grind their food. Kids are playing with it. Some are hammering with it. They don't know what this thing is. Now, what's interesting here is that the Bushman of the Kalahari is seeing the same thing that we're seeing. We're seeing the same thing that he is seeing, but we're not perceiving it the way he perceives it. He's not perceiving it the way we're perceiving it. There's a difference between seeing and seeing as. We both see this object here, but we don't see it as the same thing. We see it here in this room as an empty glass Coke bottle, but he doesn't. Okay, so sense experience and perception are different things. And this is very important for us to communicate to our students. And you could actually do it at the eighth grade level. it's something they have to continue thinking about throughout the poetic stage. But you just tell them, look, are we, the Bushman and us, having the same sensual experience of this? We're seeing, you know, something that's translucent, the tactile feel of it, it's hard. I'm good, thank you so much, I appreciate that. But he doesn't know what it is, and we do. We think of it as glass. Well, what's glass? Glass is, you know, a hardened form of molten sand. We think of it as, in terms of its origin, well, how did it get there? It was made, it's man-made, in a furnace, in a blast furnace, in a factory. Why was it made? To contain liquid. It's a vessel, particularly Coke, right? It's an American product. It's made to, it's very popular. There's a certain connotation that goes with Coca-Cola, right? All of these are things that we think onto the object. That's the way we perceive the object. And this is showing us that facts aren't simply what you see. Facts are how you interpret it. We'll talk more about this momentarily. But the same principle applies all across life. If you drop the Bushman into this room right now, he would not understand most of what's in this room. He would see it all, hear it all, but would not perceive it the same way we do. Some of you are probably watching World Cup. And if you're not familiar with soccer, you just see a bunch of guys running around chasing a ball. But if you are familiar with soccer, you see plays. You see setups. You see strategy unfolding. Likewise in baseball or football. Those of you who are trained in art and music. You don't just hear noise coming out of a stereo. You hear cellos. You hear certain instruments. You hear rhythm. You hear a style. You say, oh, that's Bach. You're not just hearing. You're perceiving, right? You walk into a Korean restaurant. You don't just smell. You perceive kimchi, right? And the list of goes on and on. Detectives and forensic science. I love forensic science shows because these guys walk into a room and they see the same thing, excuse me, that we all see. But they immediately perceive evidential clues of what's gone on, blood spatterings. They can look at blood spatterings and determine which direction the gun was shot just by looking because they've been trained to perceive the facts for what they are, the objective significance of the facts. If you've seen this, you know what this is. Don't raise your hand. Anyone know what this is ahead of time? Okay. Raise your hand if you think you know what's there. Yes. It's Jesus. The fact that most of you don't see this means you need to work on your sanctification, I guess. Jesus is up there. And what's really fascinating is that most of you in this room aren't perceiving him. But you are seeing the same thing that Keith is seeing. You're seeing the exact same black smudges and marks against white. But he perceived Jesus. Any of you perceive him yet? Okay. Sorry, I've got to move on. Those of you who know about chess, if the Bushman looked at this, he would not perceive what we perceive. He would just see a strange black symbols. He wouldn't know this is a picture of a chessboard. We perceive not only that this is a game, but we perceive that these are players, pieces with certain powers and moves and strategy. And if you really know the game, you'll also perceive something funky about this. I'll give you a few seconds. Who wants to take a guess at what's funky about this? Yes. No. Yeah, look at F1. No, F1. That's an illegal move. There's no possible way that that could be there legally. Right? Now, for you, sir, to identify that means you are bringing something to this image. You get that? We're bringing things to the sense datum all the time. We don't recognize it because we're so conditioned to do it. And we think it's just so obvious that this is a chessboard, so obvious this is a Coke bottle, it's so obvious that whatever, fill in the blank. No, it's not, actually. You have to be conditioned to perceive these objects as having the meaning, the significance that we assign to them. We're going to think about this a little bit longer. Some of you chuckled. Do you think the Bushmen would chuckle at that? Why? Okay, yeah, you perceive irony here. You identify them as nuns. You're already bringing your interpretive paradigms to this. And smoking cigarettes, which have a negative connotation. Nuns are supposed to be holy, set apart, not do these worldly things. And so it strikes you as ironic, and it's funny, and it's a result of your perception. In the cultural debate today over homosexuality, which I think is arguably the next to abortion, central issue of our day, with huge ramifications. We all look at this and see the same thing. Everyone on both sides of the debate. We're seeing the same thing. But we're not seeing it as the same thing. We're perceiving it differently. One side, the supporters, say this is an expression of authenticity, of honesty. It's pure, it's good, it's wholesome, it's healthy, it's natural, it's courageous. It's to be celebrated. The other side negates all of those things and says it's unnatural, it's a perversion, it's an offense against God, it's a violation of his law, it's sad, it's bondage, it's self-deception. Notice, we're looking at the same objects and then interpreting them differently according to what? You can't just say, well, I'm looking at the facts here, and the facts tell me that. Doesn't work that way. This is an image of a fact. I would say that's a fact, right? But what's the significance of this? What's the meaning of this? If the Bushman looked at this, he would have no idea what this means. He wouldn't even know those are drinking fountains. He might even be confused by what that guy's wearing, right? He might be more concerned about what that guy's wearing. But we look at this and we perceive this as segregation, as racism, as an injustice. And that's what we're bringing to it. Now, if someone says, I only believe in facts, I could say to them, well, is that a fact? Yes. I mean, just the look, just the image. Is that a fact right there that's being recorded? Yes. Okay. And is that segregation? Are you seeing segregation? And he might say, well, of course you're seeing segregation. Well, is the Bushman seeing segregation? No. Well, then you're not just seeing segregation. Because if you could see the segregation with your eyes, so would the Bushman. Are you following this? You get the drift here? Lion King. You guys might remember this scene, for those of you who've seen Lion King, where Pumbaa, the warthog, and Timon, the meerkat, are laying on their backs looking up at the night sky. Pumbaa says, Timon, ever wonder what those sparkling dots are up there? Timon says, I don't wonder. I know. They're fireflies. They got stuck up there in that big bluish-black thing. Pumbaa says, oh, gee. I always thought they were balls of gas burning billions of miles away. And we laugh. Why? That's very funny, but why is that funny? Because he's right, and yet no one just looks up and sees, oh yeah, those are balls of gas, No, that's massive theoretical information that goes into the judgment that these are stars and so on and so forth. There's no way. Timon's answer is much more commonsensical for most of us. Think about this. We look up. Here's a great example. We look up and we say, oh, yeah, that's obviously the moon. It's a satellite. It's spherical. It's reflecting sunlight. It's hundreds of thousands of miles away. It's in orbit, gravitational pull of the Earth, and so on and so forth. It's made of dust and rock, and it's got craters. And we tell our kids this, and we're telling them what's true. But no one just looks up and sees all that. If you think about it technically, you look up and you see not a sphere, but a what? A disc, yeah, a circle. You don't see sunlight being reflected. I mean, where do you get that from? That's inference and conjecture, right? You certainly don't see what it's made of or how far it is or how big it is. You don't see any of that stuff. We perceive it. We're bringing this interpretation to the object. Now notice, this is important. The fact that we're bringing the interpretation to the object doesn't mean that we're somehow wrong. In fact, the interpretation is correct. So interpretation doesn't blind us. Interpretation can clarify and guide us and get us closer. What is education if it's not biasing our kids to interpret the world rightly? To interpret the world rightly. Just a couple more examples. I won't kick this dead horse, but obviously this is a very theory-laden perception that most of us have right here. It's one thing to just see this object. It's another thing to say that this is the result of millions of years of river erosion, and these are layers left by the river and so on and so forth, which may or may not be true. My point is simply that that is a perception, not something you just straightforwardly see. Missing links. This is massively theory-laden. So many paradigms and presuppositions go into the identification of any skull as a particular transitional form in evolutionary history. I'm not saying it's true or false. My point is simply that you can't look at these and say, well, I just believe in the facts. And this is just factually a transitional form. It's not obviously a transitional form. We could debate that depending on our paradigms and plausibility structures. Speaking of missing links, if you consider the way that a chimp would experience a spark plug, this is a great illustration of what philosophers call brute facts versus interpreted facts. A lot of intellectuals in our day, I'm speaking to you now as Christian brothers and sisters, presumably, right, think that they have the facts on their side against us. They talk that way. I only believe in the facts, and you guys bring your religion to the table. And they've bought into this very naive, philosophically naive, enlightenment notion that facts are self-interpreting. They think facts are self-interpreting. Say, obviously, this is a spark plug, right? It's just an objective fact. And what postmodernism has done, thankfully, is deflated that view. Postmodernity is all about a critique of the Enlightenment view of facts and objectivity and rationality. And the postmodern philosophers have rightly argued that, no, we interpret the world. Facts are interpreted. And they've, I think, drawn the wrong inference. They've gone to the other extreme by inferring that you can't know anything now because we're stuck behind our paradigms. We're trapped in the matrix. But they are right up to the point that facts are interpreted. So facts are not self-interpreted. We bring our interpretations to them. Now, a brute fact would be an object as a brute, as an animal experiences it. Just the sense datum. You know, the chimp and us see the same object, the spark plug. We can hold it and have the same tactile sensations. But obviously the chimp doesn't have categories, abstract categories. Won't think of it as a spark plug. Won't think of it as a part in a system called an engine. Won't think of it as made of metal and porcelain. Won't think of it as manufactured in the USA and so on and so forth. But we think all those things onto it. Because God's created our minds to map his world, and God created the world according to kinds, according to categories. The world is a plurality, unified, right? A unity and plurality. It's all sorts of different things, different contours of reality that God's made. Mathematical features, moral features, aesthetic features, material features, psychological features. These are all different features or aspects of reality. And God's created our minds to map this diverse world by coming up with abstract ideas and ordering them into bodies of knowledge, systematic bodies of knowledge, the mathematical body of knowledge, historical body of knowledge, and so on and so forth. And brutes don't experience the world this way, but we do. And once you get this, once you really start to own this fact, it changes the way you experience yourself, the world, your understanding of knowledge, of how you know, what it is to know. And it blows apart the naive enlightenment idea that you just go to the facts to figure things out. As Christian educators, we want to bias our students to think of all facts as theistic. All natural facts are what they are because God created them to be that way. They have their meaning in light of God. They have their objective significance, their meaning, because God's made them to be that way. Even the things that depart from his creative decrees. Sin is a departure, a violation of God's decretive or of his preceptive will. But even sin, even suffering, even evil only makes sense against the background of God's original creation for the world. And we have to bias our kids to understand that when we're talking about proving things with facts, that the facts are already pre-interpreted by God, and that we need to learn to think God's thoughts after him by interpreting things according to his pre-interpretation of them. This is a quote from Thomas Aquinas. He says, "Truth is found in man's intellect according as it apprehends a thing as it is, and things according as they have being conformable to the divine intellect." Let's stop there. What he means, first of all, is truth for us, we have our thoughts corresponding to things. Okay, so my belief about what a cell is either true or false according to the nature of cells. If my understanding of what a cell is at odds with what cells really are, then it's false. If it corresponds to what cells really are, then it's true. But then Aquinas takes it further, and he says a cell is what it is because it corresponds to the mind of God. Acorns and oak trees and animals are what they are because they are all instances of what God has created to come into existence. Very much as this cup is what it is because of what we've made it to be. If you were to define this cup exhaustively, you would have to reference what we have designed it to be, what its function is, and how we've made it, and so on. And that's all part of the natural world that God has created it, and we need to get the kids thinking about this. The core question then is, are we interpreting the facts consistently with God's pre-interpretation of them? This is a truly theistic Christian view of facts. I'm going to change gears a little bit here. For those of you old enough to remember Dragnet, I only watched reruns. I was born in 71. But he would often say, "Just the facts, ma'am. I just want the facts." And you've heard that statement before. In light of what we've said, we need to understand that facts are used as evidence to prove propositions, but all facts are interpreted, and therefore all evidence is interpreted. So when we're going to think about the nature of evidence, we have to recognize that evidence itself is subject to interpretation, and even our understanding of what evidence is, of what constitutes evidence, of whether it's relevant, of whether it's good evidence, will all be dependent upon our paradigms, or as they say, our worldview. And if you were to really develop this, we don't have enough time. I would love to, but if you were to really go into this, you would have to get into the nature of paradigms. A lot of great work has been done on this, how interpretive paradigms are formed and how they operate in our thinking, plausibility structures, the nature of presuppositions. There's a debate, for those of you who know epistemology, between what's called coherentism and foundationalism. Lots of issues that go into the nature of how you approach the world and interpret it and identify evidence. And the force, evidential force of any given fact will be, in a sense, determined by the paradigm you're bringing to it. Just a quick little example. When in the Gospels and Mark, when the man was identified as possessed of a demon because he was cutting on himself, right? Remember, he broke some chains that had bound him, and he was cutting on himself and acting like a madman. They identified that as demon possession. We identify that, according to our interpretive paradigm, as mental illness, most likely. Back then, it would have been very plausible to say that he was demon-possessed. Nowadays, it's no longer plausible. But what makes the difference there? It's the same fact. We're looking at the same observational data of a man cutting on himself. And we're bringing different interpretive paradigms and plausibility structures to that sense datum, to that object of experience. And the plausibility of saying it's demon possession is greatly, greatly reduced if you hold to a naturalistic worldview, right? But if you hold to a theistic worldview, a Christian theistic worldview, it's greatly heightened. It's completely reasonable to believe in demon possession. That's just a sample, just one example. What I want to do here is talk more specifically about evidence as it pertains to proof. I define for my students evidence very generically as whatever one uses to try proving a proposition. Whatever one uses to try proving a proposition. So evidence does not automatically mean good evidence. If you define evidence as what's reasonable or you know, probable, then right away you've left out the possibility of bad evidence. If you think about the OJ case, juror one says OJ Simpson killed Nicole Simpson because her blood was found on his socks. Many of you may not know that that was actually the principal evidence against him, but then it was ruled out for anecdotal reasons. Juror two says, well, O.J. Simpson killed her because he drove around L.A. like a guilty man. Now, both of those are evidential claims, but obviously the first one is much stronger. The second one's probably bad evidence. There are other very reasonable explanations for why he's driving around L.A. like this. So the fact that someone uses bad evidence doesn't make it non-evidence. We should also be careful not to identify evidence with one particular type of fact. Some people talk about facts and values. Have you heard that phrase? Facts and values, as if values aren't facts. Or the facts of hard science versus psychology. Psychology doesn't really deal with facts, they say. Physics does. Well, that's just immediately question begging and biasing to a student to tell them that facts are principally with what physicists deal with, and that what psychologists are dealing with is somehow not a fact or a lesser fact. That's immediately a worldview claim. That's question begging, and I would argue false. All right, now I want you to jump into Roman numeral 6 here. We're going to skip around at this point. Roman numeral 6. I think one very fruitful way of dividing up evidence is to think about it in terms of dialectical evidence and material evidence. Dialectical evidence is propositional evidence. It consists of words, statements. We call these premises and or reasons. Material evidence is non-propositional. This is all material evidence here. All of these images are examples of what would be material evidence used to construct conclusions. Now, you might be thinking, well, wait a second, don't we interpret this? Don't we bring propositions to it? Absolutely. Remember Johnny Cochran said, if the gloves don't fit, you must acquit, right? But notice the gloves there aren't propositional, right? The gloves aren't words. The gloves are just gloves. We interpret the connection between the gloves and his hands in light of the plausibility structure that, all things being equal, if he were the murderer, he would have been able to fit into these gloves because these were the gloves that were used in the murder. Well, his hands don't fit. Presumably, that was debated itself. So we're interpreting this, but the facts that we're using or bringing to the table are not propositional. They're non-propositional. They're just gloves and dig sites and skull fragments and, you know, stars, images of the galaxy and so on. In classrooms, we don't deal typically with material evidence, we deal with dialectical evidence. If you think about the actual experience of a classroom, in a discussion, a debate, or even in your own life, when you're conversing with your unbelieving friend next door, and you're having a discussion about things, you're generally not citing material evidence, you're using what we can call dialectical evidence. And dialectical evidence takes a variety of different forms. Common knowledge. I know that's a little bit of a questionable category. What is common knowledge? Because we disagree on things. What I think is common knowledge, sometimes people think is not. But let's say we're having a discussion about whether all of our desires, this goes to Plato's Republic, whether all of our desires are just completely arbitrary, where you can desire whatever you want, versus saying that some desires are natural and ought to be fulfilled in order to make one healthy and flourish. One could argue, well, clearly some of our desires are natural because look at infants. They cry when they're hungry. And that shows that they have a natural, inborn desire to eat. They didn't just decide they want to be eaters. They are naturally wired to want to eat because they need to eat. And then you could say, well, we all know, of course, that children, infants, cry when they're hungry. That's a piece of common knowledge. If someone said, well, prove that to me, you would say, that's just out of place. Come on. Are you serious? You don't know that infants cry when they're hungry? That's common knowledge. Or in our culture, common knowledge might be, if we're debating the dropping of the atomic bomb on Japan, we might say, hey, ultimately this was a defensive war because of Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor is common knowledge in our community. And so this is a belief that we all share that happens to be true, and we know it's true, and we're bringing that to our discussion, to our debate. We also have the word of others, right, where students are citing authorities in science, in rhetoric classes where they have to defend a thesis, they have to do research. They have to read historians and scientists and philosophers and theologians, and they say, well, according to John Calvin, or according to William Lane Craig, or, right, you fill in the blank, and you're citing someone, that's a piece of dialectical evidence because it's words. Think about this. When you read a full-length book, how often do you see pictures? It's typically just words. And you're taking those words as evidence. You're treating the ink on paper as evidence that the universe is expanding. I can't just go out and open my front door and say, yep, the universe is expanding. I have to pull out a book on cosmology, which tells me that the universe is expanding, and I'm relying on the authority of these wise guys, right? Conceptual analysis. These are oftentimes called analytical arguments in debate. If, let's say, I'm arguing about preemptive war. We did a debate on preemptive war in my debate class. And if I say, all just wars are defensive, but no preemptive wars are defensive, and therefore no preemptive wars are just. And they say, well, what do you mean by that? I say, well, a defensive war, I'll define as a war where you're responding to an attack. Someone's attacked you, and now you're responding to defend yourself. Well, preemption, by definition, is attacking before you're attacked. Therefore, it's not defensive. But if all just wars are defensive, then preemptive wars can't be just. And now we can debate this, right? You can say, well, wait a second. I don't agree with the way you've defined defensive wars. I think preemption is a form of defense. If you know that there's an imminent threat, they have the desire, the expressed intentions and ability to attack, and then you're going to intercept ahead of time, that's defensive. Well, no, I disagree, Johnny, because now, but what's happening here? At what point does someone go like this? Well, hold on. Let me show you something. Right? No one has material evidence here. It's just we're moving in the space of idea. We're thinking about ideas and beliefs and we're analyzing these things. That's how much of debate and discussion goes in life. Then, of course, there are background assumptions, and this is a tricky one. because we have so many assumptions operating behind the scenes in the way we think and talk. Let's say you're in a discussion about the Mosaic Law, the Law of Moses, and whether it's still binding, and the Ten Commandments versus the moral, or the moral versus ceremonial law, and these sorts of debates. And somewhere the issue of how many commandments are in the Old Testament comes up, and someone says, well, there's 613 commandments in the Old Testament, Mosaic Law. That's what I was taught somewhere. That's an assumption I continue to operate on, that there are 613 laws in the Mosaic legislation. Guess what? I've never counted them. I couldn't even tell you who taught me that. I went to a Bible college, and I learned it in my freshman year, probably, maybe sophomore. I don't know. I don't even know where I got it from. There are so many beliefs like that. They're just floating in our minds, and presumably we got them from good, reliable sources at some point, but who knows, right? I mean, these are things we haven't actually sought to verify. And all of these things are part of dialectical evidence. All right, now go with me to section 2B. Section 2B on dialectical proofs, on evidence. We're going to talk about non-proving and proving, justifying and verifying. Okay, well, if evidence is whatever one uses to prove a proposition, then obviously some evidence will succeed and other evidences will fail. And so we just neatly divide those into non-proving and proving. But what do we mean by proving? Well, there are two terms that I think we need to use clearly and distinctly for our students. One is justifying evidence, and one is verifying evidence. Justifying evidence and verifying evidence. Verifying evidence shows that a conclusion is true, that it is true. Whereas justifying evidence shows the conclusion is likely to be true. So verification is the strict sense of proof, and justification is the loose sense. Verification provides certainty of the conclusion's truth, and justification provides probability of the conclusion's truth. Verification is a doubt remover, and justification is a doubt reducer. And what we want to do now, with the rest of our time, is talk about how arguments as a dialectical proof. By dialectical proof, I just mean an argument where you are using premises to support your premises. When you're writing a paper, a research paper, a thesis defense paper, you've got a thesis statement that's your overarching conclusion, and then you're providing premises for that. And then you provide premises for your premises. In some cases, you go a third level, premises for your premises for your premises. Right? But it's premises all the way down. It's a dialectical proof. If you're watching a debate, same thing. You're just hearing dialectical evidence. People are speaking, appealing to your common knowledge and beliefs and assumptions, and they're appealing to authorities. And it's a dialectical proof. It's an argument. Okay. Well, arguments prove and verify or justify in two respects, inferentially and then evidentially. In the logic text, I wrote a logic text. I'm here promoting it at this conference, and I've structured the text according to three questions: a semantic question, what do the terms of the argument mean? The inferential question, does the conclusion follow? And then the evidential question of whether the premises are true. And that's an exhaustive way of analyzing any given argument. What I want to do is talk about the second and third. The inferential question, here we're asking whether the conclusion follows. Whether the conclusion follows. We're not asking about truth value. We're not asking about truth value, only whether the conclusion follows. Now, in an inductive argument, if the conclusion follows, it's called strong. Most Muslims are Sunni. Ali is a Muslim, Ali is a Sunni. That conclusion follows probably. It's likely. All things being equal, it's a reasonable conclusion to draw. The other one is a deductive argument. The conclusion follows necessarily. Necessarily. In geometry proofs, it's deductive because the conclusions necessarily follow. Or in a syllogism like this, all Muslims are theists. Ali is a Muslim, so Ali is a theist. Again, we're not talking about whether the premises are true or whether even the conclusion is true. So inferences divide according to this pattern here. Inductive are either strong or weak. If the conclusion probably follows, it's strong, otherwise it's weak. For deductive, if the conclusion necessarily follows, it's valid, otherwise it's invalid. But the problem is that false conclusions can follow their premises, and so the inferential question can't be the whole story. Muslims are midgets, Kareem is a Muslim, therefore Kareem is a midget. That conclusion follows, but the premises aren't true. And so when we're thinking about the nature of a dialectical proof, it's not enough to ask whether the conclusion follows. And let me just say here, this is why I think it's such a mistake to overemphasize the formal rules of validity. If you have a logic class that's just pounding the rules of syllogistic validity or propositional validity, you know, if A, then B, A, therefore B, it's modus ponens, that's like, I don't know, teaching pre-med students about the heart but not about the brain or something. You know, you've got to deal with the evidential side of argument. Why do we argue in the first place? I could come up with a valid argument that's just dumb. I could say, you know, all men are socks, and apes are men, therefore apes are socks. And that's valid. Well, no, who cares, right? We want to get to truth. The reason why we learn the rules of validity and probability are so that we could ultimately derive reasonable or necessary conclusions from what? True. Premises. True premises. So the evidential question, if you look to the left here, you see cogent. Cogent is an inductive argument. It's a strong argument, meaning the conclusion probably follows, and the premises are true. So most pitchers are right-handed. That's true. Chris Tillman is a pitcher. True. Chris Tillman is right-handed. That is probably true. Because I know the premises are true, I could say that probably the conclusion is true. I could have said, as a matter of strength, I could have said the conclusion probably follows without knowing anything about the premises. But notice what I'm saying here. I just said the conclusion is probably true. That's different from saying the conclusion probably follows. Do you see that? That's subtle, but it's significant. Strength tells me only that the conclusion probably follows. Cogency tells me the conclusion is probably true. How about the next one? This is a deductive argument. Sound, meaning it's a valid argument, so the conclusion necessarily follows, but from true premises. So all humans have rights, preborns are humans, therefore preborns have rights. That's a sound argument. It's valid and has true premises. But, and here's where we start, if you do logic correctly, guys, you will do philosophy. You will do worldview. This is why I hate logic texts that try to treat logic as if it's this self-contained thing that has no philosophical bias or presuppositions or demands. I thought I had another slide here. If you just look at this, this is a complete breakdown. Strong arguments to your left break into cogent and uncogent, and then valid into sound and unsound. But look at this. We said that a proposition in the beginning of this session is either true or false, right? It's either true or false. It has truth value. And that's an objective fact about the proposition, meaning that It's true or false, regardless of what you think or whether you believe it. The same principle then means that an argument, ready, that an argument is either cogent or sound. If the argument is strong, then it's cogent or it's uncogent. If the argument is valid, then it's either sound or unsound. Let me say that again. So if I know I'm dealing with a strong inductive argument, then I know right away that argument is either cogent or uncogent, but I don't know which. If it's a deductive, valid argument, I know it's either sound or unsound, but I don't know which. Until what? Until I prove the premises, until I figure out whether the premises are true. So look at this one, the cogent one. Most lifetime smokers die before the age of 70. That's either true or false, depending on how you define lifetime smoker, I guess. But the president approves a lifetime smoker. That's either true or false. I have no idea whether these premises are true or false. I have no idea. I just made it up, right? But that argument is either, I could tell you this much, it's either cogent or it's uncogent. Now I want to go figure out, is it cogent or uncogent? And so I go and I look for facts, evidence, and try to verify or justify those premises. Likewise, for the second one, it's deductive. I know that it's either sound or unsound, but I'd have to argue for the premises. You could disagree with this conclusion and say, you know what? If those premises are true, then yes, the conclusion follows. Iraqi freedom was unjust, but prove to me those premises are true. And that's where you write a thesis paper, and you're digging into evidence and analysis and research and so forth. All right, now watch what happens here when we go on to try to justify or verify the premises. In the case of strong arguments, verified premises yield justified conclusions, conclusions that are likely to be true. In the case of valid arguments, verified premises yield verified conclusions, shown to be true. We'll look at an example of each one. So here we have verified premises of strong arguments, and it yields a justified conclusion. So look at the yellow argument first. That's the main argument. 19 kids in this 20-member class are professing Christians. Joe is the 20th member of this class, so Joe is a professing Christian. Okay, that yellow argument by itself is strong. Statistically, we'd say that most likely the conclusion follows. Not necessarily, but it could. Or I mean, it probably does. But now I want to know, are those premises true? And so my evidence is, well, the first one is true because I asked them. And my evidence for the second one is that I'm his teacher, so I know he's in my class. I know he's the 20th member of this class. So without even asking him whether he's a professing Christian, I would infer, using inductive logic, that he's probably a Christian, because if 19 of the 20 are professing Christians, then most likely he is too. But my conclusion is only justified. Now, verified premises of a valid argument. This is a strict proof here because it's valid and the premises are verified. Every kid in this class has dignity. That's because the blue premise, they all bear the image of God. Whoever bears the image of God has dignity, and they bear the image of God, so they have dignity. Joe's the biggest clown in this class. As his teacher, I see it every day, so that's my proof. I verify it. So Joe, nevertheless, has dignity. That would be a sound argument that has been verified because we verified the premises. Now, we can debate on how do we know we verified the premises, and that gets us into more complicated discussion. And then the results of justified premises. This is where it gets a little bit more interesting. In the case of strong arguments, justified premises yield justified conclusions. That shouldn't surprise you. It's the next one that's weird. And this is the one I want to focus on. In the case of valid arguments, that is, the conclusion necessarily follows, justified premises still only yield justified conclusions. That is, conclusions that are probably true. Now, think about what I just said. The conclusion necessarily follows, but the conclusion is only probably true. If that seems like maybe a little bit of a contradiction, that's good, because there's something that should strike you as a bit of a tension, so I want to explain this. Let's look at three first. All right, so here, look at the yellow. 19 kids in this 20-member class are 10 years old. Joe's the 20th member of this class, so Joe's 10. It's a probable conclusion. And then I have justified premises. A parent helper told me so. That's not compelling evidence, but it's good evidence. It's reasonable. If the parent helper told me this, then most likely it's true. So I've justified my first premise. Now I go to the second premise, and I justify my second premise using the same evidence. And therefore, I end up getting a justified conclusion, because I know the conclusion follows, the argument's strong, but now I know the premises are probably true, which means the conclusion is probably true. But watch this. Here's the valid one. Look at the yellow first. All the kids in this class love to learn. Joe is in this class, therefore Joe loves to learn. That's a necessary conclusion, right? And then I go on to give evidence for my premises. I say all the kids in the class love to learn because the teacher told me so. Well, that's good evidence, but maybe some of the kids are faking it, right? So the fact that the teacher told me this gives me good evidence, but it's not conclusive, it's not certain, it's not compelling. And so all I've done is I've justified that first premise. Are you with me? I've justified the first premise, but I haven't verified it. I don't know it's true. I've just given good reasons for thinking that it's true. How about the next premise? Joe is in this class. Why? How do I know that? Because a student told me so. Well, most likely, if the student told me that, then the kid's in the class. But I recognize I'm not going to trust the word of a student with my life, right? So the fact that a student said there are 20 kids or that Joe's in the class doesn't show me that that premise is true. It just justifies the premise. Doesn't verify it. All right, now if you follow this so far, some of your eyes are pretty glazed over, so I'm not confident of that, but that means then that the conclusion is only probably true. Even though it necessarily follows the premises. A lot of you are nodding, that's good. So the conclusion necessarily follows, it's valid, but it's only probably true because I've only justified the premises as opposed to verifying them. So to wrap this up, what should we mean by proof? In a strict sense, it's a sound argument with verified premises. A sound argument with verified premises. It's valid, so it's deductive, it's valid, the conclusion necessarily follows, and the premises have been shown to be true. In a loose sense, an argument proves if it's strong, that is, it's inductive, the conclusion probably follows, and its premises have been either verified, shown to be true, or justified, shown to be likely true. And if you get these definitions down and you ensure the students get these definitions down, then you can have a very meaningful, specific conversation about whether the argument's proved, its conclusion. You could say, well, Johnny, this is clearly an inductive thesis defense paper that you've written here, and so therefore, the most you could say is that you've proven it in the loose sense. But now let's think about it, Johnny. Have you verified the premises, or have you only justified the premises? I only think you verified this premise B here, and here's why. But notice, we're using common vocabulary at this point. And Johnny can follow me. We're not in this nebulous land of, you know, using proof in a thousand different ways. But it's also important for the kids to recognize that proving is not so simple as just looking at facts. It requires interpretation. It requires reflection. It requires tons of inference and analysis and paradigms are being brought to the table. It involves critiquing paradigms, identifying presuppositions of the author. You know, read a good example of this. Read Dawkins, his book, The God Delusion. It's packed with assumption. If you went through with a highlighter, this is blue highlighter for assumption. It's everywhere. Helping the kids to recognize that it's not so straightforward as just looking at facts and consulting authorities. There's interpretive gloss going on all the time in the way that people read arguments, construct arguments, evaluate arguments. All right. Well, I'm going to be here at the table. I teach at Rockbridge Academy, and I'll be at the Rockbridge table talking about the logic text. If you want to chat about the session today, I know I hosed you there the last 15 minutes, but I'd be happy to chat with you about these things. We're a few minutes over, so I don't want to take up any of your time here.